From the Danker's studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. Today on the show, we're going to have a conversation with University of Utah legal scholar Professor Clifford Roski to hear about the ongoing legal battle over same-sex marriage in Utah.
In this case, we've said that no state shall deny any person life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and no state shall deny any person equal protection of the laws. And so the question is, what do those phrases mean, and how do they apply to same-sex couples who want to get a marriage license from the county clerk's office?
That conversation and your summary of the day's top local headlines, just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. First up, though, these messages and Access Downtown. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Stay tuned later in the program for a conversation with University of Utah law professor Clifford Roski on the debate over same-sex marriage in Utah. But first up, we have these headlines. The United States Supreme Court has temporarily halted same-sex marriages in Utah. The court voted to accept the state's application for a stay of a recent ruling by a U.S. District Court judge which legalized same-sex marriage in the state. The stay will remain in effect while the state attempts to appeal the decision, meaning no further marriage licenses will be issued to same-sex couples pending a decision by the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver. Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes says that his office is already preparing their opening brief for the appeals court.
The state's opening brief is due January 27th before the 10th Circuit. And we have been working, by the way, with the legal team on the other side on an expedited briefing schedule and hope that that cooperation will continue and appreciate their professionalism.
When asked about the hundreds of same-sex couples who managed to obtain marriage licenses before the stay was granted, Reyes had no firm answer on how they would be handled by the state in the meantime.
Going forward, I can say that we feel we're on solid ground because the stay is in place. With regard to those marriages that have taken place before the stay, again, we have not had a chance to evaluate and make a final conclusion.
The Attorney General went on to say that the state had hoped to avoid such confusion when it asked the district court for a stay back when a ruling was handed down in December by federal judge Robert Shelby. That request, along with subsequent requests for a stay to the appeals court, was denied. The legal team representing the plaintiffs called the Supreme Court's order for a stay disappointing. Noting that the order was temporary, Attorney James Magleby said in a statement, "Every day that goes by, same-sex couples and their children are being harmed by not being able to marry and be treated equally." Governor Gary Herbert called the Supreme Court's decision, quote, correct. In a statement released Monday, Herbert said, "I firmly believe this is a state's rights issue, and I will work to defend the position of the people of Utah and our state constitution." A Utah-based gun manufacturer has turned down a $15 million deal to supply Pakistan with precision rifles, citing concerns they could eventually be used against U.S. troops. Desert Tech sales manager Mike Davis says the company was on a short list for a contract with Pakistan, but spurned the opportunity because of unrest in Pakistan and ethical concerns. Davis says it was a difficult decision because of the amount of money involved, and the sale of rifles to Pakistan would have been legal. The rifles can change caliber within minutes and have the capacity to shoot as far as 3,000 yards. The U.S. often targets Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and their Pakistani supporters in the country's tribal regions. Desert Tech is based in West Valley City. Four Salt Lake City Council members were sworn into office today at noon at Salt Lake's City and County Building. Councilmember Stan Penfold was sworn in to serve a second four-year term, while council members James Rogers, Aaron Mendenhall, and Lisa Ramsey Adams took their respective oaths of office to serve their first terms. The oath of office ceremony was held outside on Salt Lake City Hall's East Steps, and the One Voice Children's Choir, Kenshin Taiko Group of Drummers, and the Salt Lake City Fire Department all took part in the inauguration program. And those are our local headlines for the day. I'm Roger McDonough. You're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. On December 20th, 2013, Utah became the 18th state where same-sex marriage was legal when U.S. District Court Judge Robert Shelby ruled that the state's ban on same-sex marriage violated due process and equal protection provisions of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. After Judge Shelby's ruling, nearly 1,000 same-sex couples in Utah were married. Today, though, the future of those marriages is in question. This morning, the Supreme Court of the United States granted a stay to lawyers for the state of Utah, effectively outlawing same-sex marriage in the state once again. Today on The Rundown, we're going to air a conversation we recorded this weekend with Clifford Roski, a law professor at the University of Utah who teaches courses on criminal law, constitutional law, and sexuality, gender, and law. At the end of this interview, we'll feature a couple of follow-up questions we asked Professor Roski today in the wake of the Supreme Court order handed down this morning. Professor Roski, thanks for joining us today. Maybe you could help me understand, first off, Judge Shelby's decision and the rationale behind it.
So Judge Shelby was asked to decide whether Utah's Amendment 3, which is, as you said, a state law that bans same-sex couples from marrying in the state of Utah, whether that law is unconstitutional, whether it violates the federal constitution. So Amendment 3 is an amendment to Utah's state constitution, and it says same-sex couples can't marry in this state, and if they're married in other states, Utah will not recognize that marriage. But no provision of Utah law is permitted to violate the federal constitution. And the plaintiffs in this case, three gay couples, claimed that Utah's laws banning same-sex marriage violated the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, in particular, the Due Process Clause and Equal Protection Clause.
Hmm. And this is a little bit complicated. Utah's lawyers, the Attorney General's office now, I read that part of the state's argument is that some of the irreparable harm could be caused to these couples who have married themselves, that this is they want to, quote, avoid needless injuries to same-sex couples and their families that would follow if the marriage licenses that they obtained as a result of the district court's injunction are ultimately found invalid. So I'm wondering if the state is trying to say that they're asking for a stay to actually protect gay people.
I think that's what they're asking for. But as you suggest, it's a strange request for the state to make in this case. It puts them in the position of arguing out of both sides of their mouth. That is, on the one hand, they're saying that they have the right to ban same-sex couples from marrying and that that ban does not inflict an unconstitutional injury on those couples. And yet, on the other hand, they're asking for a stay because they're worried that if the marriages are invalidated after the fact, that those couples would be harmed. But if invalidating those marriages would harm the couples, well, then the law is probably unconstitutional, and the state is not likely to win its appeal. It's just a very confusing argument, and I think that's why the district court and the Court of Appeals refused to issue a stay, that they said, you know, the plaintiffs represent the gay couples in this case. Apparently, they want to be married. That's what they said, and so, indeed, two of the couples have gotten married now. But, you know, the state is defending the ban on same-sex marriage, saying that it doesn't injure same-sex couples in a way that harms their constitutional interests. And the plaintiffs are representing same-sex couples and saying, well, we want to get married. We want our marriages to be valid and treated equally. And so for the state to turn and say, well, we need a stay to protect same-sex couples against the possibility of their marriages being invalidated, that's the relief that the state is seeking, is the invalidation of those marriages. So it's a bit of a tough argument to make.
If you have a sense of this, what's the next step for this this decision and what will happen?
In terms of what happens next, it actually doesn't matter whether the stay is granted. That is, there will be an appeal heard by the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. The case will probably be argued in March, if not then, maybe in May. The state's opening brief is due in January, mm-hmm. and the plaintiff's response in February, and all the briefing will be concluded by the end of February.
And so the stay is meant merely to halt marriages in the state?
Absolutely. The stay is a temporary order that would pause the enforcement of the lower court's order. That's all it is. It's called a stay pending appeal. Mm-hmm. So it only lasts as long as the appeal lasts. And then we would expect a decision within months, although this is an expedited case, so the 10th Circuit may make a special effort to rule quickly.
Mm. You know, and I'm I'm sorry, we're going to focus on the stay for just a little bit longer here, but I'm curious about how the decision is made to pursue that stay by the state of Utah. Is there something automatic that happens there? Is the attorney general making a decision by himself? Is he taking direction from the governor to make this choice to pursue appeals and stays?
So in cases like this, we often talk about the state of Utah as if it's a party to the lawsuit, a defendant. But the truth is that the defendants are specifically the governor and the attorney general, and they're two separate defendants. And each one of them gets to decide whether they will appeal and whether they will seek a stay, and all of the decisions they get to make themselves. Because they both represent the state of Utah, I'm sure that they're consulting each other on these kinds of decisions. But strictly speaking, the governor has a lawyer, his general counsel, and the attorney general, of course, is a lawyer representing the state. And so the attorney general would consult with his staff in making the decision, and I'm sure with the governor and the governor's counsel.
This is a little bit different than reactions we've seen in places like New Mexico and New Jersey, where, for example, in New Jersey, after same-sex marriage became legal, Governor Christie dropped the state's challenge to the ruling, citing tax savings, as well as a wish to put a divisive matter in the past. And in New Mexico, where same-sex marriage became legal on December 19th, Attorney General, this is the day before the ruling here in Utah, Attorney General Gary King said he was pleased with the high court's decision. Of the rest of the states where same-sex marriage has become legal as a result of a ban being overturned, do you know if those other states have appealed the decisions the way that Utah has?
So the most famous case in which the state decided not to appeal a ruling was certainly the Proposition 8 case in California. There, the governor, who was Arnold Schwarzenegger at the time, and the attorney general, Jerry Brown, both decided that they would not appear in court to defend Proposition 8. And when the district court held that law was unconstitutional, they elected not to appeal. And that actually ended up having significant consequences in the case, because the sponsors of Prop 8 attempted to intervene and appeal. And when they got to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court decided that they did not have standing to bring an appeal in that case, and the case was dismissed. And that's, in fact, why we don't know now whether states have the authority to ban same-sex marriage. That question was before the court last year, but it was dismissed on the sort of technical ground.
Of standing,
yeah. Huh. And there's one other prominent example of this, which is the Department of Justice and President Obama declined to defend the Defense of Marriage Act in court. They stayed within the appeal and made sure that that Congress would have an opportunity to defend DOMA all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. But the president and the administration did not appear in court defending the law. In fact, they took the position that it was unconstitutional. So there are precedents for attorney generals and governors standing down and recognizing the right of all same-sex couples to marry.
Governor Herbert has called Judge Shelby an activist judge who is attempting to override the will of the people of Utah because Amendment 3 was passed by a large majority of people here in Utah. Then I'm wondering if you want to comment on that concept of activist judges. I know that Shelby was supported by both Senator Hatch and Senator Lee here in Utah when he received his nomination. But let's get this out of the way. Is there a sense of a judge interpreting something to enact an agenda?
Yeah. I think it's really important for people to understand that no one ever asked the district court what it thought of same-sex marriage. And the district court's opinion doesn't say, Judge Shelby does not say, I like same-sex marriage. All of that, his sort of personal opinions are irrelevant to the question he's asked. In my experience, judicial activism is a word that people throw out when they don't like a decision that a judge makes. And so you hear that on both sides of the aisle pretty frequently. It's true that Amendment 3 was passed 10 years ago with a significant majority of Utahns, and in that sense, it reflects the will of Utahns. Now, honestly, 10 years later, BYU polling suggests that the same majority of Utahns, 60% of Utahns, now support civil unions for same-sex couples, all the same rights and benefits as marriage. Civil unions are banned by Amendment 3, so there's a clear sign that public opinion has shifted in the last 10 years. But even putting that aside, the issue before the court was whether our state law, which reflects the will of Utah voters 10 years ago, is in conflict with the federal constitution. Now, the federal constitution reflects the will of the American people. This particular provision in the 14th Amendment was enacted in 1868 by a significant majority of states. And so, you know, federal law always trumps state law when they're in conflict. So the only real question here is, are they in conflict? Does the will of the American people conflict with the will of Utah voters?
And I guess that has a lot to do with a sense of protection of rights as opposed to denial of rights.
Yeah. I mean, so the question, you know, when we pass constitutional amendments at the federal level, it's very difficult to do that. And so when we do that, we try not to make specific provisions. We've actually had a pretty bad history of that. The two most obvious specific provisions were that African-Americans had 3/5 of the vote. That, of course, was repealed, indeed, by the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments. And prohibition in the 20s. And so generally speaking, we've learned the lesson that when we pass a constitutional amendment at the federal level, we want to do that at a broader level. We announce broad principles. And in this case, we've said that no state shall deny any person life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and no state shall deny any person equal protection of the laws. And so the question is, what do those phrases mean, and how do they apply to same-sex couples who want to get a marriage license from the county clerk's office?
I'm going to jump us away from that for just a second to ask about how the Supreme Court's rulings on the Defense of Marriage Act and California's Proposition 8 set the stage for this. I mean, this is, to a certain extent, allows for the decision by Judge Shelby and other judges to happen, right?
Indeed, I would say more than allows, it commands the decision by the district court. So last summer, the Supreme Court had two major landmark gay marriage cases before it. One was whether California's Proposition 8, which was in some ways similar to Utah's Amendment 3, violated the federal constitution. And as we talked about earlier, that case was eventually dismissed on somewhat technical or procedural grounds that the governor and the attorney general had failed to appeal. But the other case was about the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. So that was a law passed by Congress in 1996. The Defense of Marriage Act didn't say whether same-sex couples could marry. That's a question of state law. What it said was, if a same-sex couple was married in a state like Iowa or Maryland or Massachusetts, that marriage would not be recognized for any purposes by the federal government. And the most obvious issues here is that means that same-sex couples couldn't file a joint tax return with the IRS. They couldn't seek Social Security benefits if one of the partners died. There were immigration implications.
Estate tax issues, for example.
Estate tax issues actually is the one at issue in the case itself. Last summer, the Supreme Court struck down the Defense of Marriage Act as unconstitutional. And the way they did that is quite significant. They had essentially two choices. They could have said the Defense of Marriage Act is unconstitutional because it violates states' rights. Mm-hmm. States have complete authority to define marriage, to determine who gets married and who doesn't. They did not say that. They talked about the traditional authority of states to regulate marriage, but every time they did, they reminded the states that any regulation of marriage must comply with the respect for individual rights. Hmm. And then they explained why the Defense of Marriage Act was unconstitutional. And here the language was quite unambiguous. They said that the Defense of Marriage Act was unconstitutional because it injured, stigmatized, and demeaned same-sex couples, and harmed and humiliated the tens of thousands of children being raised by same-sex couples. If the Supreme Court would say that about a law that merely denies benefits to same-sex couples, imagine what they would say about a law like Amendment 3 that actually tells same-sex couples, you can't marry, and if you're married somewhere else, you're not married here. It's hard to imagine a greater stigma imposed on same-sex relationships than to say, no marriage, no civil unions, no domestic partnerships.
Specifically denying benefits is the point. I mean,
not just denying benefits, but even the status of marriage itself. It's one thing to say you can't file a joint tax return, you can't seek Social Security benefits. The Supreme Court saw that as a grave injury and a grave insult to same-sex couples and their children. But Amendment 3 actually denies the marriage license itself. Mm-hmm. You're not married. You may think you're married, but you're not married. That's what Amendment 3 says to same-sex families in Utah. When you then read the paragraphs that talk about the children of same-sex couples, I think that's when that argument clearly fails. I think that's when the Supreme Court tipped its hand about what's going to happen next. To say that a law denying same-sex couples the right to marry or to have their marriage recognized financially harms children by denying them benefits and humiliates them by telling them that their parents' marriage isn't worthy of respect, that has nothing to do with states' rights. I mean, children are innocent. They don't choose the families in which they are born or raised. And so if the Supreme Court thinks that the Defense of Marriage Act was humiliating tens of thousands of children, there's no way out of that part of the logic. When you're humiliating children, you lose. There's no, well, I know we're humiliating children, but here's a justification for doing so.
I'm wondering if you have final thoughts on the direction we're headed. Is it inevitable that all 50 states will see legal same-sex marriage? Of course, nothing's inevitable, but do you have thoughts on our future here?
I think it's very likely that as this case and other cases work their way up through the courts, that within the next few years, we will see the United States Supreme Court grant the freedom to marry to same-sex couples in all 50 states.
And as I mentioned earlier today, the U.S. Supreme Court granted Utah's request for a stay, meaning same-sex marriage is again no longer legal in Utah. Because Justice Sotomayor referred the request to the entire court, their decision to grant the stay can't be overturned, while an appeal to Judge Shelby's ruling is pending in the 10th District Federal Court. Professor Roski rejoined us via phone this afternoon to discuss this latest development. Professor Roski, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you.
Are you surprised by today's order from the Supreme Court?
Well, I'm disappointed. I'm definitely disappointed, and I am surprised. I did not expect the Supreme Court to issue a stay. And more importantly than my feelings, it's very disappointing for same-sex couples in Utah, not only the 1,000 couples who've already been married in the last 2 weeks, but the many couples who haven't had an opportunity to marry yet. You know, these are people that love each other. Many of them are raising children together. And now that this stay has been granted, they have to worry about whether the marriage that they lawfully entered is going to be recognized by the state and the courts. And that's sad.
But for the time being, those people who were married in the state of Utah, they're still legally married, right?
Well, this is complicated. There's no question that the marriages are legal and valid. They were entered pursuant to a lawful court order. But now that that order has been stayed, the state of Utah may refuse to recognize those marriages, just as it refuses to recognize marriages from same-sex couples who were married in other states, like California or Iowa. Ultimately, whether Utah must recognize those marriages is something that will be decided by the federal courts in the appeal itself. This is not a hypothetical. This is actually in the case. One of the couples in the case got married on a Friday afternoon after the judge issued his ruling, and there's no question that they are legally married, but I'm guessing that the state of Utah is not going to recognize that marriage, and they're going to ask the courts whether that's constitutional. And in fact, another one of the couples was married in another state. So you have both of those issues.
Both to be determined. Why do you think Justice Sotomayor referred the state's request for a stay to the entire court?
She didn't provide any reason for doing so, but it is common in issues of public importance to seek the input from all nine justices. Okay. I mean, this happened just last month in an abortion case. Justice Scalia referred the issue to the full court, so it's common.
The Supreme Court order, the full court handed down a unanimous, I mean, it's not a decision, but a unanimous order for the stay. Does that suggest anything?
Well, what it suggests is that it's not about the merits of the case. There's no way that you would get a unanimous decision if what the Supreme Court was doing was deciding whether or not this law was constitutional. I think the fact that it's a unanimous decision strongly indicates that the justices simply thought it would be prudent to hit pause on gay marriage in Utah and allow the courts the opportunity to let the case work its way through the normal process.
And I don't know if we've had much of an indication from the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, and maybe we don't know what's going to happen next.
No, we do know what's going to happen next. The briefing schedule has been posted. So the briefs are written arguments, and they will be submitted by the end of February. And the case likely will be argued in March, although they haven't said exactly when it will be argued yet. And then either the losing party will appeal to the full 10th Circuit instead of just the first three judges that hear it, or they will appeal directly to the Supreme Court. And the earliest the Supreme Court could accept the case and hear it would be in the fall.
But in the meantime, we have the granting of a stay affects tax filings, benefits of spouses, et cetera, while this case is on hold.
That's really up to the state of Utah. Because the court's order has been stayed, Utah can argue that it doesn't have to recognize the validity of these marriages while it's pursuing this appeal. And so in that case, the state can make decisions about things like joint tax returns and adoptions and things of that nature. And of course, those decisions would be effectively challenged through this lawsuit and resolved in the lawsuit itself.
Okay. Well, Professor Roski, thank you once again for this update and for your time.
Okay. Thank you.
That was University of Utah Law Professor Clifford Roski. You can find this conversation and all of our interviews at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. Thanks once again for tuning into The Rundown. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Mr. Tyler Ford, and Ryan Cunningham. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, tune in for a conversation about digitizing historic Utah newspapers with John Herbert from the University of Utah's Marriott Library. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.